Senator Stevens, Huggins. My good friend Bert Stebman has joined us now, Senator Wilkowski, and my good friend Tom Wagner from the Kenai. Senator McGuire is excused, and I'd like to recognize that we have both of the Ericksons with us today, busily writing with their right hand. Welcome. Today we have with us Kathy Forrester, if you would come, Commissioner Kathy Forrester, if you would come forward, Kathy. And let me just give a quick overview about what we're going to be doing initially and what our focus and Senate resources is going to be this year. Number one, it's gas pipeline, gas pipeline, gas pipeline. And in that respect, we thought a good starting point would be with gas offtake, because that's where the gas comes from and ever how much we can get, and the ramifications of that I think are important for us starting off. And then we will go to a quick conversation about national and or international and national tax regime on gas, and with the end state of that in the intermediate being looking at a couple of windows where we as a legislature and administration can target to address that subject, to address the subject gas tax. I think it's important that we anticipate and we kind of generally speaking have the same concept what a primary window will be, what an alternate window would be. Then subsequent to that, next Monday, we will get together and discuss at least one bill, if not multiple bills, that will be on the docket, followed by a series of presentations beginning with ConocoPhillips from people that made proposals or some that chose not to make proposals, and with the intent of figuring out to the extent they will share with us what data they may have that might be germane in our decision-making process, information gathering. Now, equally important in that, in my estimation, I haven't talked to any other of the committee members, minus Senator Wagner. I talked to him a few moments ago, that I thought it was important for us, and I told Kevin Banks this, for us to begin a conversation between the legislature and the gas team to assimilate information as appropriate as we go forward with this objective. At the end of 90 days, we have an up or down vote that's taken on gas line yes, gas line no, as it's brought forward to us and with an applicant's name to it. And to do that, in my estimation, it will take maximum effort of communications, cooperation, and in the end, we can't start too early. So in that spirit, we're starting today. We will meet tomorrow, and we will continue to meet in that spirit. Have I said enough yet, Kathy?
You sound wonderful. The longer you talk, the less I have to.
And of course, we have some people that are on teleconference. Do you have anybody that's going to be online for us,
no.
Kathy? Okay. And you know, obviously, this is day one meeting, and everything is written in pencil. But the intention is good, but. I firmly believe it's like anything, intentions are good, being fluid, dynamic, and malleable is important for all those mental aspects. With that, Kathy, please.
Chairman Huggins, Vice Chairman Stedman, Senators Green, Stevens, Wilkowski, and Wagner, thank you very much for inviting me here to share with you some information about the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, or AOGCC, the work we're doing.
Excuse me one second. Let me recognize we have some representatives and senators here. We have two senators, Senator Dyson, Senator Thomas, and my good friend Mike from the House of Representatives. Welcome to each of you. Thanks for your interest. Are there others? And I don't want to miss anybody. Good. Thank you. I'm sorry. It's yes. Representative Hawker.
Quite all right, sir.
Please.
Thank you for inviting me here to talk with you about the AOGCC and the work we're doing to help prepare the state for the eventual sale of our North Slope gas resource. Chairman Huggins' office gave me a list of topics to cover, and I hope to address them all and make them weave together into something that makes sense. I'll start with some background information that should help in understanding the issues before us. First, I'll give a brief description of the AOGCC's statutory responsibilities, just to put into perspective the small but important role that we will play in the state's quest to achieve North Slope gas sales. I'll then give a brief description of the main sources for North Slope gas sales in context with the Security and Exchange Commission, or SEC's, reserves classifications, which will be important for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, process that we'll have in an open season. After that background information, I'll give you what I hope to be a thorough yet easy-to-follow description of the issues concerning us at the AOGCC for Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, along with the status of our work in understanding and resolving the issues in each of those fields. Then I'll describe the process that operators must use to get a gas sales allowable from the AOGCC. I'll end with some take-home messages so that long after you've forgotten the boring engineering stuff I tell you, you can remember what I hope will assist you during your decision-making process this session. Before starting, I do want to apologize in advance if I get too engine nerdy. To help with that, your first handout attachment is page one. It's a glossary of acronyms so that I can give you the alphabet soup and you don't drown in it. And please interrupt me at any time if you have any questions. So referring to page two of your handout, you'll see a list of the statutory responsibilities of the AOGCC. In our day-to-day regulatory oversight, we're called upon to exercise all of these responsibilities in a variety of ways. And I'm sure the same will be true as we regulate operations relating to North Slope gas sales. But the two responsibilities I want to focus your attention on today are preventing waste of hydrocarbon resources and encouraging greater ultimate recovery of hydrocarbons. I ask you to keep these two in mind as we proceed with the rest of our discussion. And I also ask you to keep in mind that nowhere in our list of responsibilities will you find mention of making the most money, balancing the budget, or keeping any one set of constituents happy. You guys have the tough job. We just have to deal with the science. The second bit of background information we need to discuss is the reserves classifications of the SEC. Page three of your handout is the long version, which you can find on the SEC's website. But for those of you who will trust me, you can turn to page four of the handout, which is a boiled-down version, and it's the one that I'll be talking from. For a gas pipeline open season, the FERC will only entertain nominations of gas reserves that are recognized by the SEC as proved. The SEC breaks down proved reserves into two categories, proved developed and proved undeveloped. Proved developed reserves are hydrocarbons that can be demonstrated with reasonable certainty to exist, that are economically extractable using proven technologies and at current prices, as well as for which the wells have been drilled and the production equipment installed. Proved means you can prove that it's there, you can prove that it makes sense that you can get it today with today's prices and technology. Developed means you've spent the money and all you have to do is open the valve. Essentially, all of the oil reserves at Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk fall into this category. And for the sake of our gas discussion, the Prudhoe Bay gas cap would be considered proved developed once there's a gas pipeline at the front door. Proved undeveloped reserves are hydrocarbons that can be demonstrated with reasonable certainty to exist and that are economically extractable using proven technologies and at current prices. However, for proved undeveloped reserves, the wells have not been drilled, nor has the production equipment been installed. BP's Liberty Field would be considered to contain proved undeveloped reserves. But once they build the infrastructure and drill the wells, those reserves will move to the proved developed category. Again, for the sake of our gas discussion, Point Thompson would be considered proved undeveloped. Those are the two classifications of reserves reported to the SEC and the ones that will play a role in an open season. But there's a third category of reserves that most companies keep track of internally but do not necessarily report to the SEC. Different companies have different names for this category, and some companies even break this category up into subcategories. But regardless of what you call this category or how you subdivide it, this is for the hydrocarbons that don't meet the SEC's definitions for proved developed or proved undeveloped. For our discussion, let's call these potential reserves. And most companies I've worked for call them potential reserves. There is some level of uncertainty to the reserves that fall into the potential category. You cannot demonstrate to the satisfaction of the SEC that the reserves exist, or you may not know that they're there, but you cannot prove them to be economically extractable using today's technologies. The Ugnew and some of the other heavy and viscous oils on the North Slope would fall into the potential reserves categories. Although we can prove they exist, we've drilled through them numbers of times, we cannot extract them economically using existing technologies. For the sake of our gas discussion, all of those yet-to-be-discovered gas fields on the North Slope can be considered as potential reserves. And there are even a few discovered gas reservoirs on the North Slope. For example, Shell's Burger Prospect in the Chukchi Sea, where they know that there's gas, but they don't know how much there is or whether it's enough for them to commercially develop. All of those potential gas fields may or may not exist. They may or may not be big enough. They may or may not be economically extractable using today's technologies. The SEC doesn't recognize them, and FERC will not consider them in an open season. But if they are as plentiful as we hope and suspect that they are, then they will play a very important part in North Slope gas sales. And we need to keep them in mind as we move forward towards our North Slope gas pipeline. That concludes the background information I wanted to share with you. So now we'll dive into the meat.
You have questions for the background information? Please, thank you.
That either means that I did a really bad job or a good job, so I'm an optimist. Good job. Okay. I said that one of the pillars of our mission at the AOGCC is to encourage greater ultimate hydrocarbon recovery. For over 30 years, we've been working hard to ensure that the North Slope operators are maximizing oil production and to encourage them to achieve greater ultimate recovery of that oil. And with a gas line on the horizon, we'll soon be doing the same with natural gas. And in fact, we've been protecting that resource all along through our no-flaring policies and our gas disposition procedures. And just as I mentioned, there are three major sources of gas supply from the North Slope: the proved developed reserve at Prudhoe Bay, the proved undeveloped reserves at Point Thompson, and all of those potential reserves in those yet-to-be-discovered gas fields. Let's look at each one of those resources individually and consider their interdependence, because there is an interdependence. The first major gas source is the gas cap of the Prudhoe Bay oil pool. This resource is estimated at about 24 trillion cubic feet, or TCF. It's a huge resource, which all by itself could fill a 4 BCF a day gas pipeline for over 15 years if you assumed no decline. And remember, this resource will be proved developed once we have a gas pipeline. We know it's there. We know we can make money producing it. The infrastructure's in place, and the SEC will consider it during an open season. So given all of that, why are we not already selling the gas? For very good reasons. Every bit of that gas has been and is still being put to very good use for getting oil out of the ground, and not just at Prudhoe Bay, but in other fields across the North Slope. I'm going to say that again because it might be one of the most important things you hear me say today. Every bit of the gas at Prudhoe Bay has been and is still being put to very good use, getting oil out of the ground at Prudhoe Bay and in other fields across the North Slope. And that use of the gas is the best use we could put it to, period. The gas in the Prudhoe Bay gas cap is essential for oil production from Prudhoe Bay in a number of ways. Page 5 of the handout is a cartoon that illustrates how these different mechanisms are at work. First, and most importantly, the gas that is reinjected mains the reservoir pressure that is necessary to move the oil from the reservoir to the wellbore. Without reservoir pressure, there would be no oil production from Prudhoe Bay. About 7 BCF per day is reinjected for pressure maintenance. And before that gas is reinjected, natural gas liquids, or NGLs, are extracted from it. A portion of those NGLs are blended with oil and sold down the Trans-Alaska pipeline. This blending process has already yielded about 500 million barrels of oil sold, and it's continuing to contribute to the oil sales volumes. A second huge benefit of reinjecting the gas is that it strips out oil out of the gas cap in a process called vaporization. This process will yield about 2 billion of the total 13 billion barrels that we expect to recover from Prudhoe Bay oil pool. So without the reinjection, that's 2 billion barrels less that we would be getting. Third, some of the gas that is produced from the Prudhoe Bay oil wells, about a third of a BCF per day, is mixed with NGLs and reinjected for Enhanced Oil Recovery, or EOR, in the Prudhoe Bay Oil Pool and its satellites. EOR is yielding an additional 500 million barrels of oil from Prudhoe Bay and its satellites. So there's another 500 million out of that 13 billion. Additional gas and natural gas liquids are exported to other North Slope fields, such as North Star and Kuparuk, for their uses. So not only is the Prudhoe Bay gas increasing oil recovery from Prudhoe Bay and its satellites, but it is also contributing to the greater ultimate recovery of oil in other North Slope fields. Of course, some of the produced gas, less than 0.5 BCF per day, is used for fuel to keep the infrastructure operating. Without the production equipment and the other infrastructure running, there would be no oil production from Prudhoe Bay. Page 6 of the handout illustrates the contributions that the gas has made and continues to make to oil recovery at Prudhoe Bay alone. And remember, some of the gas is also at work in other North Slope fields as well, and those contributions aren't shown on this chart. So let's take a look at the chart for just a second. I'm going to move off the script. The dark green, the first chart talks about projected ultimate liquid recovery in billions of barrels. The second one is a percent of the oil in place, because even in the best situations, you don't get all of the oil out that's in the ground. You typically get about 25 or 30% with primary recovery, and then everything you do after that is gravy. And so what I hope you see is that we're getting a lot of gravy from the gas. The original...
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Kathy, while we're here and we've been talking about gas liquids, going to back you up just a little bit, can you expand a little bit just so people understand? I know a lot of public are watching. So they understand the gas liquids, what is taken out each day, their value, and what their value is when they go in the pipeline.
Senator Wagner, through the chair, right now we're producing about 395,000 barrels a day of oil from Prudhoe Bay, and that includes the NGLs that are blended with it. We're producing about, 7 or 8 BCF a day of gas that just naturally comes out entrained in that oil, and a whole lot of water as well. The water is all reinjected into the reservoir to maintain pressure, and the majority of the gas is reinjected into the gas cap for the same purpose. So that oil rim that's in the middle is getting squeezed from below and above, below by the water and above by the gas, to keep the pressure high enough so that the oil can continue to flow. So most of the gas is going back in for that purpose. All the water is. The oil is going down the line. Some additional oil is stripped out of the gas and blended with it's NGLs. It's blended with the oil and sent down the pipeline. Some of it is sent to other fields, and they use that and those NGLs and gas to do the same things that are happening at Prudhoe Bay: maintain the pressure, strip the oil with EOR. And when you produce, for every barrel of oil that you produce, an equivalent in BTUs or heating value, good rule of thumb throughout the world is about 6,000 cubic feet per barrel. So for every barrel of oil you produce, an equivalent value of heating can come from 6,000 cubic feet, or MCF as we call them. So if you try to, going to your question about value, oil tends to have a little higher value than gas does. So in value, a barrel of oil is worth more than 6,000 cubic feet of gas, but in heating value, that's about the same.
I was looking more at the value of the liquids and the injecting liquids in the line and sending them to market.
The gas liquids.
The gas liquids that you produce.
Oh,
the ethanes.
Sending the gas to market.
Yeah. Right now, we're putting a lot of that into the tap line.
We're putting NGLs in.
Yeah.
NGLs. And those natural gas liquids, they're blended with the oil, so they're essentially the oil. They have essentially the same value as the oil.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a quality bank where everybody's, Kuparuk crude has a different value than Prudhoe crude, has a different value from West Sac, and the NGLs have a slightly different. But there's a quality bank that kind of balances these things out and makes sure everybody gets paid their value. But In broad general terms, once those NGLs hit the pipeline, they're oil.
Okay.
Kathy used the term a whole lot of water. Would you give us a ratio of what a whole lot of water means?
In any oil field, when you start producing it, if it's a good oil field, you're going to be producing black oil. And as the pressure drops and as the oil depletes, and if you have an active aquifer, the part of the reservoir that contains the water, and it moves in, then the amount of water and gas that you produce in conjunction with that oil increases. So you may start out with a lot of your wells being 95, 100% oil, but over time it moves the other way. So I would say that now you've got a lot of wells at Prudhoe Bay that are producing in the 60 to 90% water cut.
So we
always used to say when I worked for ARCO that Prudhoe Bay was a water field. It used to be an oil field, but now it's a water field.
Yeah.
Because you're producing more water than you are oil.
And if you would, as I understand it, there's also a saltwater component now. Could you?
That's all saltwater.
All saltwater.
That is saltwater. Right. It's all from the reservoir, and they take water from the sea to use. And they did that a lot more before they had enough coming out of the wells. But at the onset of Prudhoe's production, when they didn't have much water, they were pulling in from their seawater treatment plant salt water and injecting that at the base for that pressure maintenance. But all of it is salt water.
Yeah, but for no other reason, let's just assume volume that you're dealing with, it causes the price of processing to go up. Would you agree with that?
You have a set size of facility, and people talk often about, well, now that the facilities aren't full anymore, we should be able to put other people's oil in. But the facilities are full, they've always been full, and they probably always will be full. But in the onset, they were full of oil, and now they're full of oil, water, and gas. So it costs the same to process fluids, no matter what you're processing, and it costs the same to pull it out of the ground, whether it's oil, gas, or water. So,
but with the ratio of 9 to 1,
you're making less money. You're not making money off of selling that water, right?
Right.
Yeah,
they
haven't found a pickle market for that water.
The processing
yet.
Cost goes up
in relation to the barrels of oil produced.
Right. Yeah. That's
exactly.
I just
think
it's important for us to all understand that, particularly.
Right. Okay. So. I hesitate to go back to this graph because it's generating all the questions, but let's go back to the graph. In 1977, the operator had estimated about 9 billion.
We do not have color, okay, or I don't. So when you're going through that, just keep that in mind.
Let me give you mine, and you guys can share it. And I apologize for that. You want to give me yours?
Oh, you certainly may have it.
I'll hold it up as we're going, see if people can see it. Yeah. All right. So the dark green, the bottom part, is what would be recovered under primary recovery on all of the graphs. Now, in 1977, the operator expected to produce a total of about 9 billion barrels of oil, and about 7 of that was going to be from primary recovery, and another billion of it was going to be from water flood, and another billion was expected to be from this gas cycling vaporization process. That's what they expected in 1977. However, with essentially the same original oil in place, they didn't find more oil, so they're dealing with the same reservoir. So with essentially the same sized reservoir, improved technology, just understanding how to make things work better, things like horizontal drilling, GHX expansion, gas handling expansions, a variety of expenditures and technological advances. Now the estimate is that we're going to produce over 13 billion barrels of oil from Prudhoe Bay. And again, you can see that in addition to water flood and the vaporization, we've also got the NGL production and the EOR production that have added to make the total of 13 billion barrels of oil a day. So the second graph is just the same information, but instead of in barrels, it's in percent of ultimate recovery. So one of the nice things to recognize here is, if you remember a few minutes ago, I said that most reservoirs, if you don't do anything other than drill the wells and open the valves, you're going to get 20-25% recovery. We're going to get close to 60% of the oil that's in place at Prudhoe Bay, and that's darn good. So that's
Senator Wilkowski, question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you expect that in the coming years, as technology further increases, that will increase those numbers even more?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I hope that as BP continues to operate around the world and have research labs and donate to schools and improve, you know, work towards improved technologies, that they will find additional advances, but it's going to be diminishing returns. You know, the low-hanging fruit has all been plucked, and I'm optimistic that by the end of the day, you know, I'm going to say it's more than 13. Right now it's about 13 that they're projecting, but I'm optimistic that it's going to be a, you know, 13 plus. I'm not enough of a gambler to say it's going to be 14, but I think it's going to be 13 plus, and I think they will continue to squeeze that turnip a little harder. Okay, we're going to go back to my script, unless there are any more questions. I always get in trouble when I get off the script. Okay, if you believe,
if I might, using your graph, and if you open the conversation about going forward with heavy oil, how do you see that complicating our life? And I know Kuparuk, I guess we're already in the heavy oil stage to a much more major degree. How does that complicate our life in production and cost and pressurization? Does it change in that paradigm?
Well, these numbers that you're looking at on this chart are just for the Prudhoe Bay oil pool. Okay. They're not for the heavy oil reservoirs. But when you get into the heavy oils, that's part of that interdependence that I was talking about, where of the different reservoirs on the North Slope. You know how Prudhoe Bay gas and NGLs are being exported to other fields to help them? One of the emerging technologies, well, actually, it's been around for a while, but we're starting to play with it on the North Slope, is can we deviscosify or decrease the heaviness, you know, lighten up, loosen up that heavy oil by exporting gas and just gasifying it? Will that make it more mobile, make it easier to produce, make it move it from potential into proved reserves? So that's another possible use for the gas from Prudhoe Bay. But before you get all nervous about that, CO2 is a very good product for helping to make heavy oils producible. And when we sell gas from Prudhoe Bay, we'll have to strip off the undesirable, the unsellable commodities. And there's about 12% of the gas that we produce from Prudhoe Bay will be CO2. We'll strip that off, and we will use that to make those heavy oils saleable.
Right.
So it's all interdependent. You can't look just at one little pool without thinking about how what it needs or what it does impinges on another pool.
Yeah, and there's a lot of progress being made, I think, in the business of clean coal technology for energy production, and sequestering coal, or correction, the CO2 is a big piece of that. Is there any difference in sequestering in our oil fields with using CO2 than there is in other chosen locations to use CO2 or to sequester it?
Senator Huggins, yes. In most lower 48 applications where they are truly sequestering the CO2, sequestering is just a nice fancy word for get rid of it.
Right.
And when we use CO2 for EOR, we'll be sending it down into the ground just like they will any place else they sequester it, but we won't be getting rid of it. We'll be seeing it again, because eventually it will come back out, because the fluids that you inject into an EOR process, you will see again.
Right. And let me ask the one follow-up on that. It has to do with environmental concerns. Do you see on the horizon, if we make the assumption that CO2 will be part of our concept of extracting future oils, that there will be a potential uprising, I'll use, in some communities to say, we're not confident that that's not going to contribute to greenhouse gases.
Senator Huggins, I would never suppose to be able to predict what uprisings will occur.
Right.
But from my experiences with CO2 and from the work that the AOGCC does with underground injection control in association with the EPA, I'm confident that the procedures and the mechanisms and the technology is in place right now to prevent that environmental concern from becoming a reality, and I'm confident that that will always be an important part of what the AOGCC does, unless somebody takes it away from us and gives it to somebody else. But that's part of what we do. We make sure that stuff that gets injected underground goes where it's supposed to go, stays where it's supposed to stay, and doesn't do any damage.
Right. Yeah. For the record, if you're confident, I'm confident. Thank you.
For the record, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to make one more attempt to put away that graph I never should have gotten out and talked about. All right, so if you believe what I've said so far, then your next question might be, how will we know when the time is right to start selling the gas? To answer that question properly, you have to take several things into consideration, so let's just do that. First, most of the gas is being used to maintain pressure in the Prudhoe Bay oil pool so that we can recover that huge oil resource. So since that's the case, the later we start to sell the gas and the more aggressively BP has been producing the oil in the meantime, the less oil will be left in the reservoir at risk of being lost to decreased pressure or other reservoir mechanisms associated with selling the gas. So later is better, and encouraging BP to have the valves full open and be applying all their technology in the meantime, that's the right answer. Second, we'll want to continue EOR projects in Prudhoe Bay and other North Slope fields as long as they're yielding increased oil recoveries. So again, the later we start to sell the gas and the more aggressively that we've been producing the oil in these EOR projects, the more likely we are to reap their full benefits before the gas is all gone. But even after we commence North Slope gas sales, we can still use some of the available gas for EOR. Also, we'll be generating CO2, as I talked about, as a byproduct of our natural gas production for sales. And this CO2 can and should be used as an EOR fluid, and it can go into those heavy oils. But it'll probably be used in Prudhoe Bay first. It'll probably be used in the conventional oils as an EOR product before it moves into the heavy oils. But, that's... my crystal ball is not that clear. Fuel use is the only use of the gas in which it's all gone once we're done using it. In the other uses, the gas has gone back in to the Prudhoe Bay oil pool or another oil pool, and most or all of it can be recovered later as production of oil and gas continue. Since the fuel is gone once we use it, then obviously we will not want to be using gas for fuel when we reach the point where the fuel we're burning has more value than the oil it is being used to produce. In other words, if the oil production gets to be so low that we're using way too much gas to produce a little bit of oil. That said, was that a hand up?
Oh, Senator Wilkowski, sorry. Thank
you. As you re-inject the gas back into the ground, do you lose some? I imagine you do. And if you've got, you're saying you've got 24 trillion cubic feet, MCF, you're reinjecting a huge chunk of it every day. I imagine you lose some. I mean, are we at risk of losing a significant amount, or is it just an insignificant amount as you reinject it?
Well, other than fuil, okay, in oil field vernacular, it's called fuil and shrinkage. Fuil is, those are your losses. That's what you call your losses, fuil and shrinkage. Fuil is the sizable component. Shrinkage is those little round-off numbers that between the pumper and the gas plant and the gallon in Anchorage that turns in the reports, a little bit gets lost. That's your shrinkage. So fuel is really the only loss that is quantifiable.
Is it a significant amount for fuel and for shrinkage?
That's what I'm about to tell you.
I saw a lot of numbers there. I didn't really understand them. I was hoping
okay.
You could.
Okay. Since the, trust me, you'll understand me.
All right.
And if you don't, I'm going to stop when I finish this paragraph.
Yeah, just for clarification, so we're all on the same sheet. and to include our Alaskans out there in their homes, fuel means we're burning it. Is that
right,
true?
Right. The fuel that's used to run the Prudhoe Bay field. Okay. Since the fuel is gone once we use it, we don't want to use it when we're not using it for a bigger benefit. Okay. The current fuel usage at Prudhoe Bay is about 460 million cubic feet a day. Using that 6 MCF per barrel conversion I told you about, that's the fuel equivalent of about 77,000 barrels a day. But again, in the dollar value equivalent, it's a lower number. Okay, so that 77,000 barrels a day is being used to produce about 395,000 barrels of oil. In other words, every equivalent barrel of fuel is used to produce more than 5 barrels of oil. So we're still doing the right thing with the resource, and we will be for quite some time. So in engineering, you do things, trend analyses. You do a production plot on a certain type of paper. It's called semi-log paper. And then you extrapolate, and you get your trends and your predictions from that. And using one of those simple trend analyses, we predict that we'll still be doing the right thing with that fuel until after 2030. Okay, now I'm going to pause and say, Senator Willikowski, through the chair, did I answer your question?
Just if I could, Mr. Chair. So that seems like a lot to me. We're burning 77,000 barrels per day. That just seems like a lot to me. But
it is a lot. But have you been up to Prudhoe Bay? There's a lot of equipment that eats fuel.
And is have you determined, obviously, is it in our best interest to burn off 77,000 barrels a day to extract this? I mean, that just seems like a lot to me.
Senator Willikowski, through the chair, my husband's an accountant, and he would tell me that if I were going to spend $77 to get $395, that would be a good use.
Yeah.
As an engineer, I can't answer that question, but my husband could tell me that would be true.
Yeah, and just a comment. When some of us were down visiting Alberta and the oil sands, they're using about 1 BCF, as I recall, and they're projecting in the future, and let's call it the next 10 years, someplace in that category, potentially north of 4 BCF. It's a huge amount. But they have a different proposition, but it's heavy, heavy, heavy oil, I guess, for lack of a better term, with a grain of sand in the middle of it.
So we're getting a five-for-one return on our fuel investment. And, again, according to the trend analyses that we've done, it continues to be better than a one-to-one proposition until well after 2030. Okay. Last session, I described to you a Prudhoe Bay reservoir study that the AOGCC had recently completed with the assistance of a reservoir engineering consultant and the cooperation of BP and the other Prudhoe Bay owners. I would say that study was a success because it provided the AOGCC with the insights and understandings of the Prudhoe Bay oil pool that will assist us in future Prudhoe Bay gas offtake allowable decisions when we're called upon to make them.
Kathy, question for you, because I've been asked this multiple times. What does a study like that cost Alaskans?
The Prudhoe Bay study cost Alaskans, let me get my numbers out, about $570,000.
Okay. Well, $500,000.
$500,000, right.
Senator Willikowski.
Thank you. Just real quick, getting back to that 77,000 barrels to get 395. What's the break? What's the point, the crossover point? The point where you say it's no longer worth spending? Is it 100,000? Is it 200,000? I mean, what is the crossover point for you? Because we're burning away our resource to extract that. I mean, and
it's when the analysis that I quoted you in which I said when it gets to be a one-to-one, you know, that would be when you're producing about 80,000 barrels a day and you're to sell and you're producing about 80,000 barrels equivalent of gas for fuel. So, you know, that's when it gets to be a one-to-one, but there are other things to keep in mind because at that point, the Prudhoe infrastructure is such a critical piece of the infrastructure for its satellites and for the other areas of the North Slope that it might be a place where it would even be better to be losing a little money at Prudhoe for the bigger picture of the rest of the North Slope to be going. But for the 2030 later number I gave you, I assume when it hit 1-to-1, it was bad.
Just one last follow-up. If there's no other way to get this out. There's no other economic engineering way to get out that 395,000 barrels other than to burn off 77,000.
Well, when you burn off 77,000 barrels a day of fuel, you're heating the camps that people live in and work in. You're running the gas compressors that reinject. The big piece, a big, huge piece of it, is reinjecting that gas to keep the pressure up. So if you shut off those compressors and said, we're going to save some fuel money, there goes that pressure that I was telling you about. You need that fuel to run the pumps that pump the water, that gives you the pressure from below, that runs the compressors that give you the gas from above. So if you decide to save your 77,000 barrels of fuel, you've just lost the field.
You shut down your revenue. And as I recall, we're also using steam, which has to be heated or on the horizon. I'm sorry, Senator Wagner.
Well, I was just going to say those equivalent barrels of fuel are equivalent of gas to oil. And if we weren't using that gas, we would then maybe having to use a portion of our resource that we're extracting that's much more valuable than the gas.
Right.
So maybe that's the context to look at it.
Right, and again, you, as Senator Wagner says, the gas has a lower economic value than its heating value. So that 6-to-1 is a generous comparison for the gas.
And we also, don't we get paid for some of that gas? Now, it's a small percentage. But the free gas is only that gas that's used in the process. If it's used in heating or another use consumed like that, isn't that a chargeback? I think it.
Senator Wagner, through the chair, you've stepped outside of my area of knowledge.
I remember somebody saying that at one time. It's a small percentage, but I think it is.
It's a low cost factor, though.
Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. Going back to the Prudhoe Bay study. This is where Senator Wilikowski is going to really start to spin. Remembering last year how unkind he was to me when I called in from a sick bed for this.
Yeah, we'd like to watch that part.
The confidentiality agreement we signed prohibits me from sharing many of the details of that study. But I told you last session that even if I could share the data with you, there's not one right answer for when and how much gas to sell. There will likely be oil losses in any gas sale scenario, but the amount of those losses depends on a number of variables. The smaller the volume of gas taken out for the sales, the later we sell the gas, the more aggressively BP has been producing the oil, and the more and more effectively the mitigation steps BP has been enacting to prevent the oil losses, the smaller those losses would be. To ask me to tell you what the right number is would be like me asking you to tell me all the line items and their dollar amounts in your 2015 budget, but do it right now.
Yeah, Senator Wilikowski's spinning.
and I remember distinctly the conversation, and it was an interesting discussion. And the question I had was, do we have enough gas for the gas line? And so you're the Oil and Gas Commission, and so that was my question. And I'll ask that again to you. I mean, do we have enough gas to build a gas line that's being proposed by TransCanada or by ConocoPhillips? Do we have enough gas to fill the line without significantly impacting our oil production?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, this is outside of my area of expertise, but what I have been told is that for the long-term viability of a gas line, we need to make additional discoveries. That you can't build a gas pipeline on just Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. You have to be betting on those potential reserves as well. That said, I think the question you're asking is a slightly different question. I think what you're asking is, by the time there's a gas pipeline, will all the gas be used for fuel and it'll all be gone? Will you give them enough allowable? Do they, you know, what's the answer? I think you're asking me what the answer is. And so you want me to read that last paragraph again? I will. But
you don't have the answer.
No, I don't. What's the 2015 budget going to be? Just kidding.
Well, I mean, if I could, Mr. Chair, I mean, I think this is a really critical question, because if we're in the process of developing a gas line, we obviously, everyone in Alaska wants a gas line. I think Alaskans need to know that we've, and companies need to know that we've got enough gas to fill that gas line. And so that's all I'm getting at. And I think Alaskans want some assurance.
Okay. Well, if you let me continue, I think that I'll give you all the assurance I can give you from the authorities that my commission has. But I can't control how many discoveries anybody else makes to provide the long-term viability of a gas pipeline. And
Kathy, if I might, I mean, the answer today, no pipeline, probably not adequate gas, if you include Point Thompson. But the assumption that additional gas will be available in about 10 years, the probability of that's pretty high. Is that accurate?
I would say that's accurate.
So the paradigm changes over time,
right,
which says gas pipeline will work enough volume. And, by the way, the confidence level of how much gas is out there is very high. Is that accurate?
According to the USGS, I don't want to quote a number, but it's between 100 and 300 trillion cubic feet of potential undiscovered gas resource. So, you know, that's in that category. You can't prove it's there. But I've never worked in oil province that wasn't pretty gassy. So,
would you say that one more time?
I've never worked in an oil province that wasn't also pretty gassy.
Okay, good.
So,
good. Thank you. Art, continue.
So, you know, I can't guarantee you that we're going to find 200 trillion cubic feet of new gas.
Right. Please continue.
Okay. Okay, one other thing to keep in mind is that the AOGCC does not typically dictate to operators what they must do. Rather, the operator typically comes to us with a request for permission to do something, and we either allow it, disallow it, or allow some modification to their original plan. For instance, we didn't tell Pioneer where or how deep to drill their Ugarook wells. Rather, they sent us a request to drill a particular well in a particular location to a particular depth, using particular procedures, and we would either approve their request, deny it, or approve it subject to some limitations or modifications. The same will hold true for gas offtake allowables. We will not dictate to the Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson operators what volumes of gas to sell and when to start selling. Rather, they will come to us with a request to sell a certain volume starting at a certain date, and we will either allow it, disallow it, or allow a smaller volume.
Thank you. And on the Prudhoe Bay operating agreement, I've heard conflicting things. I've heard some people say that once you hit, say, 2 BCF, then all gas has to be sold. I've heard the exact opposite, which is that no gas can be sold unless you have the agreement of all the operators. And do you know how the Prudhoe Bay operating agreement is interpreted in that regard, as far as selling of gas by individual producers?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, no, I do not. And the operators or the DNR would probably be the best place to go for the answer to your question.
Yeah, and we need to ask that question when they come. That's an important question.
Okay. Now, I know that at least one of you is still impatient for the answer, so let me give it to you. Everything I've said about later and lower rate being better is still true, but within reason, whenever we get a gas line and whatever the gas sales volume, again, within reason, is called upon from Prudhoe Bay, it will be the right answer. are you spinning slower now? Okay, remember that there are 24 TCF in the Prudhoe Bay gas cap. Using that simple 6-to-1 gas to oil conversion, that means there are 4 billion barrels of oil equivalent in that gas cap. Remember, too, that as of today, there's a bit less than 2 billion barrels of oil remaining that is considered producible in the Prudhoe Bay oil rim. Also keep in mind that when we sell the gas, we will not lose all of the remaining oil, rather we'll lose a fraction of it. So, further, in any major gas sales scenario, it will be several years before gas sales can commence. So there'll be less oil left in the oil rim, and the operational steps that BP uses to mitigate those losses due to gas sales will be further developed. Thus, we'll be looking at losing a small fraction of a much smaller number in exchange for getting 4 billion barrels of equivalent from the gas. So I don't need my accountant husband to tell me that 4 billion is better than a small fraction of what's left over of 2 billion. Okay? So does that help you out at all with not worrying about us saying no? Okay. In other words, the right answer is that we will want to sell whatever volume is needed from Prudhoe Bay, and we'll want to sell it whenever it is needed to ensure that the gas line is a go. But that right answer assumes that the Prudhoe Bay operator aggressively produces as much oil and puts in place as much mitigation for losses as possible before the gas sales begin. So we've got this 2 billion barrels that we're stewarding right now. We want to get as much of it out as possible before we start gas sales. And we want to have as much mitigation steps, as many mitigation steps in place, like water injection into the gas cap, things that maintain pressure, so that when we get to the point where we have a gas sales line, there'll be a tiny, tiny bit of oil left at risk.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Are the Prudhoe Bay operators aggressively doing this?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. Yes, they are. They have they performed a water injection into the gas cap study, and they have been very pleased with the results, so they've been expanding that. So what they're doing is they're taking water, as I told you before, they're awash in that. So they're taking some of the water and injecting it into the gas cap in certain areas to prove the concept that they can do that without causing sloshing around of the liquids, because water is heavier than either the gas or the oil. And if you inject it high up, you want to make sure that as gravity does its thing, it doesn't do damage to your producibility. And their concept is working, and they're expanding it. Also, you've probably heard a lot about horizontal extended reach, multilateral drilling. That enables them to go into old well bores that don't have any oil left in their area of investigation and drilling out of them into new areas and getting oil that might otherwise be left or might take a long time to get. And EOR, their EOR processes are working very well. So those are the proven technologies that operators use to get as much oil as quickly as they can and to prepare for when that gas is not going to be there. And, yes, they're doing those things.
Kathy, just for a moment, how many years' experience do you have on the North Slope?
I beg your pardon?
How many years do you have experience on North Slope?
On the North, I've been in Alaska since 1992.
Okay.
And I've worked in one capacity or another as a petroleum engineer, working North Slope fields that entire time. So what is that?
Yeah. In your present capacity, how long?
I've been an AOGCC commissioner for almost three. It'll be 3 years in March.
Very good. Very good.
And before that, I spent a long time in the lower 48. I have 30, more than 30 years total petroleum engineering experience.
Right. If you were characterizing your organizational relationship with the operators on the North Slope, the oil industry, how would you characterize that? And I'll ask you, is it harmonious, as an example, or is it competitive, or how would you characterize your relationship? Your organizational, not your personal.
Our organization, because of the things that are our mission, I'd say that I can't speak to past, but the organization that is there now is highly professional, very experienced. They take their jobs very seriously, and I think they do a wonderful job. Because of those prongs of our responsibility, it's important that we keep a friendly but not too friendly relationship. We're the police for those guys, so we can't be their best buddies.
Right.
But we are trying to encourage them to do the right thing, enable them to follow our rules, because, if we're having to go in and shut them down because they didn't follow their, if we're being the nasty police all the time, then that doesn't encourage greater ultimate recovery, greater production.
Right.
So we try to collaborate, cooperate, but we also are there to be the cops when we need to.
Yeah. Okay. Working for both parties, at least from your perspective?
I can't speak for BP, Exxon, or Conoco, mm-hmm. or any of the Cook Inlet operators, or Pioneer, or But my sense is that it's working. We feel that they can come to us. We feel that they do come to us when they don't understand something, when they need an exception. And yet I don't feel that they're coming to us saying, hey, do this favor for me. Don't tell anybody I'm going to blah, blah, blah. You know, none of that is going on that I'm aware of.
Right.
But they come to us appropriately. So I'm comfortable with the relationship we have with industry.
Let me ask you, in assuming we have a gas pipeline in 10 to 15 years, somewhere in that window, have you thought about, or do you have a professional opinion of when the crossroads of value of oil and gas to market happens?
Senator Huggins, I have not done a projection of when that will happen, but in answer to the question, what I would say is that we'll be selling both of them for a long time. And people talk about the Trans-Alaska Pipeline only being able to hold 100,000 barrels or whatever. We'll be selling oil from the North Slope when we have to truck it off the slope.
Okay.
In my opinion. I think that there will be operations for a long, long time.
Yeah, and one follow-up, and Senator Wagner has a question. I've heard from multiple sources of a varying number, but let's call it 300,000. At a point in at about 300,000, that the challenges of moving oil through taps may be beyond the economics. If it's outside of your realm, that's okay. Okay.
Economics and pipelines aren't my thing. I apologize.
I'll talk to her later then, because I was going to ask you a question about chokes and reconfiguring the pipeline, because it can be done. And
right.
I've talked to a lot of people who have a lot of pipeline experience, and 300,000 is not a reasonable number.
Right. Senator Wagner, through the chair.
What they say.
They can do things. They can reactivate pump stations that they've shut down, and there are things that they can do to get a longer life out of that pipeline. That's exactly right.
As I understand, UAF has a task force that's working on reconfiguring what goes through there and the practicality and the physics and the value. But anyway, please continue.
Okay. Let's see. All right. In other words, the right answer is that we'll want to sell whatever volume is needed from Prudhoe Bay, and we'll want to sell it whenever it's needed to ensure that the gas line is a go. I may have already said this. But the right answer assumes that the Prudhoe Bay operator aggressively produces as much oil and puts in place as much mitigation as possible before we begin. I did say that already, but it doesn't hurt to repeat it because that's very important. The second major gas source is Point Thompson. So if you have any more questions about Prudhoe, this would be a good time to ask him before we move into Point Thompson.
Okay, proceed.
Okay. The gas resource in Point Thompson is estimated at about 9 trillion cubic feet. This resource by itself could fill a 4 BCF a day line for another 6 years, assuming, again, no decline in production. But production does decline. Okay, and remember, this resource is classified by the SEC, or will be, as proved undeveloped. We know it's there. We feel confident that we can make money producing it, and the SEC will consider it during an open season. So what are our concerns at Point Thompson? Most people think of and even refer to Point Thompson as a gas field. But in engineering vernacular, it's what we call a gas condensate reservoir or a retrograde condensate reservoir. And under the definitions in the AOGCC regulations, it's an oil field. I won't drag you through all the technical explanations of what's going on in such a reservoir. If you want that explanation, you can refer to the handout that's in your packet titled Role of the AOGCC in Approving Pool Rules for Point Thompson Field. But let's go right to the bottom line of that handout. Looking simply at the technical issues, not getting into financial concerns or politics, cycling the gas until the liquids have been recovered is always, always, the way to achieve greater ultimate recovery and prevention of waste from a gas condensate reservoir.
Well, I'm sorry. Can you say that again in something I can understand?
And define what liquid is. So
okay. I'll have to go into the paper a little bit and use my hands, but that's okay. In a gas condensate reservoir, in the reservoir, all of the fluids are in a gaseous phase. However, as the pressure drops, some oil falls out. And that oil falls out in the reservoir, and some of it, as the gas is produced, will fall out in the well bore and in the production facilities. So as pressure drops in a gas condensate reservoir, oil drops out. And when the pressure drops and the oil drops out in the reservoir, it doesn't come to the surface. It stays in the reservoir forever. And it tends to drop out where the pressure is the lowest. And where the pressure is the lowest is right next to the well bore. And as that stuff drops out right around the well bore, remembering that this isn't a big cavern, you know, or Walmart shelf that we pull the oil off of, it's rocks with little tiny pore spaces that this gas and oil travel through. And as that oil falls out in those little tiny pore spaces close to the well bore, it plugs up those pore spaces and makes it difficult for the gas to come out. So you've got that liquid resource staying down there in the worst possible place. So not only are you going to lose that liquid resource that the pressure has dropped and it stays out in the reservoir, but you're also going to plug up those wells and make it harder to get the gas out. Did it make sense?
Yes, but don't ask me to repeat it in an hour.
Okay, and when I talk about cycling, what cycling is you produce that gas, you run it through a gas plant, you strip off the liquids, you put those into a sales line, and then you run that gas through some compressors and use Mr. Wilikowski's fuel and send it back down into the reservoir so that that pressure stays high enough that the oil doesn't drop out. Okay?
Thank you.
Almost sorry you asked. Okay. There are two important considerations in producing Point Thompson as a gas reservoir without cycling first. Number one, a significant portion of the liquid hydrocarbons will drop out and be lost in the reservoir forever. Number two, these dropped out liquids will most likely cause increased operating costs and decreased gas recovery from the gas wells as they drop out in and around the well bore and plug up those pore spaces. Let's look first at...
Kathy, let's go back, and I know you explained to Senator Stevens, but, I mean, forever, I mean, there has... If we're doing all sorts of recovery with lots of challenges in some areas, I assume it may not be cost-effective, but there would be a way to recover it. Is that...
Well, Senator Huggins, the studies that have been done on retrograde condensate reservoirs indicate that even if you... regret your bad choices and decide to go back and try to fix things, and you go back in and you pressure up the reservoir, you inject something back in to get the pressure back up,
right,
you still won't get those liquids.
Okay. So
never
say
never.
Do it smartly. Do
right.
it smartly.
So when I say forever, that's not in geologic terms. That's in what we know about right now. Yeah. Okay. Let's look first at the liquid hydrocarbon losses, since the AOGCC is charged with ensuring greater ultimate recovery and preventing hydrocarbon waste. Publicly available estimates of recoverable liquid hydrocarbons associated with the gas at Point Thompson vary from 200 to 400 million barrels, depending upon the source. Using our Prudhoe Bay logic, losing this resource would be a small price to pay to get the 9 TCF, or 1.5 billion barrels of equivalent, from selling the gas. However, we have time right now to be developing Point Thompson, cycling the gas, and recovering those liquids. If we were doing that, then we could have both the liquid recovery in the interim and the gas sales when the line is ready. And don't let me underemphasize the size of this liquid resource. 200 to 400 million barrels, that's another Alpine field. Okay. And if we were to recover those liquids through cycling in advance of gas sales, then the second concern would also go away, the concern of damaging in the near wellbore area. And I'm not going to read that because I've already explained it to you, unless you want to hear it again. Okay. These are important to the AOGC, because not only will we lose liquid, but we'll also lose some of the gas resource when this... occurs. Now, it's important to the state for that reason, and because under ACES, the state shares the cost of the interventions that will likely need to be done over and over again to move that liquid out of the way and enable those gas wells to keep producing. So if we're a partner in those operating costs and we're doing something that's causing liquids to drop out around the well bore, then every time the operator goes back in and spends money to move that liquid out of the way so the gas can keep coming, we'll be paying for it with him. However, for fair and balanced reporting, and Kevin Banks will probably talk about this tomorrow, I must also say that cycling will likely add significant capital costs, which the state would again share under ACES. So it's a trade-off that you have to realize.
Let me ask you a question with a two-part answer. Share with us in 30 seconds or less for each part your one greatest success in your 3 years in doing the things you described to us thus far, and one that you'd regret the most in the decision-making process interfacing with the industry.
Ooh. Senator Huggins, me personally?
No, you're
the AOGCC.
Yep.
I think that one of the biggest successes that we've had is that we have worked to develop revised regulations in areas where our field, where the technology and the operating conditions have changed, and our regulations weren't doing the right thing. You know, we've either completed or are in the process of completing safety valve system regulations, gas storage reservoir regulations, suspended wells, abandoned wells regulations, so that some of those things that we're supposed to do every day are done properly. And I would say another big accomplishment that I'm particularly proud of is that we were able to, and I think that the Prudhoe Bay operators should take equal pride in this, is that we were able to negotiate successfully with them to do the Prudhoe Bay study for $500,000, because I think you've probably seen a proposal from the DNR to do a study that they want $10 million to do. So accomplishing, getting the understanding that we've gotten from Prudhoe Bay for $500,000, although that's a lot of money, and I would hate to spend it if it were my own money. You know, I don't have it to spend. I think that was a very good use of the state's money. And
right. Congratulations.
Thank you. Biggest regret.
If you don't have one, that's good. Congratulations on being successful.
My biggest regret would have to be that we haven't always left Juneau with every single one of you guys feeling confident that we're taking care of all of our responsibilities to your satisfaction.
Good luck.
Ms. Willikowski.
Continue on, please.
Senator Stevens.
Help me understand, what are the capital costs in cycling that we're going to share again?
I'm sorry. Senator Stevens, through the chair. Remember I said you'd take that gas, you put in a gas plant that would strip it out. That would, you'd still need to do that either way, but then you'd take it to a compressor for reinjection and you burn up some fuel when you do that. That's the piece. If you don't have to reinject it, you don't have to put in those big compressors that can get it up to that high pressure it needs to get to and send it back down into the ground. That's the biggest piece of the capital cost. Is those is that gas handling. The AOGCC is engaged in a study similar to the one that we conducted for Prudhoe Bay to understand the Point Thompson resource. We're in the very early stages of this study, so we have very little data and are far from having any conclusions. The Point Thompson evaluation process used by ExxonMobil is more complex than what we used with BP for the Prudhoe Bay study, so we anticipate that it could be as long as another year to a year and a half before the study is complete. Even though the two reservoirs are completely different, as are the two evaluation processes, we're optimistic that this study will also be a success and that at its conclusion, we'll have the insights and understanding we need to help us make good regulatory decisions concerning development, operation, and gas offtake at Point Thompson. For example, ExxonMobil has taken different positions over time on whether or not to cycle, first for liquid recovery. And their latest, I think, official position is not to cycle. At the completion of our study, we expect to know enough about Point Thompson to decide whether or not we agree with that position. Even without any results of the study, I can tell you one thing. Time is the important thing to keep in mind at Point Thompson. Right now we have time to develop the field, to produce the liquids, cycle the gas. But the longer Point Thompson remains undeveloped, the less time we will have. You may remember that I mentioned a third source of North Slope gas. I'm leaving Point Thompson now. I can come back to it, but this would be a wonderful time to ask any Point Thompson questions you have.
Senator Wagner.
Just so the committee and the public understand, Kathy, could you go in a little bit to the pressures that you'd be dealing with this reservoir? I'm thinking, remembering that we're talking about 2,500 pounds in the pipeline that we're talking about building. So
you'd have to pressure the gas up to about 10,000 pounds to get it down into the reservoir at Point Thompson. So this is pretty heavy metal you're dealing with and pretty high tech. And that's why it's expensive. Well, everything's expensive on the North Slope, but this is real expensive. That's a very good question.
And what role, in your estimation, does a successful gas pipeline bear on the success of Point Thompson's further development?
Senator Huggins, there are 9 TCF of gas to be produced from Point Thompson, right. And that will not happen without a gas pipeline. And some fraction of the 200 to 400 million barrels of oil will be extracted simply through gas sales, but it will be a small fraction. And a larger fraction would be realized if we cycled first.
Right. And the infrastructure required to get the oil to market, have you seen the estimates on that?
Senator Huggins, the infrastructure to develop Point Thompson would be, first they'd have to put in the drilling and production facilities,
right.
And then they'd have to drill the wells. And if you're drilling into a 10,000-pound reservoir, then that's those are going to be expensive wells.
Right.
So there is an enormous capital cost associated simply with getting Point Thompson to the point that you could turn on a well, no matter whether it was going to be a gas well or an oil well. But then you've got, you know, depending upon which way you go, cycling or not, you've got compressors or no compressors. But there's a pipeline that goes to Badami, and Badami is not that far from Point Thompson. And so you would have to do a small oil pipeline to connect you to Badami. And I think the Badami line has some spare capacity. And in fact, I think Badami is on cold shutdown right now, so the whole line is available.
In your estimate, when you look at Point Thompson, you factor out gas, is there a profit to be made on oil?
Senator Huggins, again, I don't know the economics. I don't know that there's a profit to be made on the oil. All I know is that the physics say that the only way to get the majority of that oil is to cycle it. The economics will have to be considered.
Right.
And to the extent that our statutes allow us to consider economics, we will. In fact, we've asked for a legal opinion through the AG's office on how we can consider economics in our mission, because if you look at our statutes, they're pretty there's no mention of even a penny, you know, that money's not part of what we do. But for realistic recovery, we're going to have to be able to know to what degree we can look at economics, and that is an unknown to us right now. So mealy mouth, wishy washy answer, but I don't know a better one. I apologize.
Thank you very much.
Okay, now we're going to talk about those the third type of gas, the potential gas. Okay, all those yet to be discovered gas fields. The USGS and the MMS estimate potential for over 150 TCF. I knew a number. 150 TCF of conventional gas on the North Slope. Anadarko is exploring for gas this season. God bless them. The sooner we find new gas fields and the more gas that we find, the less pressure there will be to accept oil losses at either Prudhoe Bay or Point Thompson. And that gas will be necessary to give the gas pipeline the longevity for our kids and our grandkids, and probably for the long-term viability economically. So please keep this third and very important gas source in mind as we move through North Slope gas decisions. You know, as you're making the decisions you make, please keep in mind to leave the door open for new discoveries to be made.
In the context of a gas pipeline in open seasons, as I recall, I think I saw a media account with, I believe, well, in any event, one of the representatives from Anadarko, and they were talking about they may not be able to make the first open season and may have to come in to ask for an open season provision expansion. Is that accurate?
I don't know the timing of the open season, so
okay.
I don't know. And if they get a successful well, if they get great, if we have a long exploratory season this year and they get good tangible results fast, they may be at a point where they could make a first open season. But, you know, the exploration gods and the timing of the open season. The last topic I was asked to address is the process by which an operator receives a gas offtake allowable from the AOGCC. Two scenarios trigger the AOGCC to take action. The first is responsive. We respond to a petition or a request from an operator or another interested party. The second is proactive. We act out of our own volition, but then we do that only to prevent imminent waste. In the case of North Slope gas sales, there is no sales capability. There's no pipeline there, and thus no imminent waste, so there's no need for us to act. Therefore, we will respond to a petition from the Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson operators.
Stand by when we have questions. Senator
Wilkowski. Thank you. I guess I want to take a little bit of an issue with that statement that since there's no sales capability on the North Slope, there's no imminent waste. We are burning the equivalent of 77,000 barrels of oil equivalent, which is a tremendous amount. I just heard a report today on the radio that 25% of all the greenhouse emissions are come out of the North Slope. There's just tremendous amounts of fuel being used up there. So I guess I would take issue with that statement, that because there's no market for it, there's no potential for imminent waste. I mean, we are burning huge amounts. What's the value of 460 MMCF? I mean, how much, what's the value of that on the open market? Let's say we were able to get that on the market. That's got to be millions of dollars.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I haven't been following gas markets, so I don't know the exact price.
$8
an M times 460 M. So it's an enormous value, but what's the value of 395,000 barrels of oil a day? You know, you can say that we're wasting the gas, or you can say that we're using the gas to get the oil. And because the AOGCC looks at it as using the gas to get the oil, we don't consider it waste.
Yeah. Stand by one. We have a broad-shouldered Alaskan, Kevin Banks. Have you tabulated that yet? Okay, well, we'll be standing by. We got a few moments yet.
So 8 times 460, did I say? So 8 times 5 is 40. So what is that, $400,000 or $4 million or $400,000? I haven't got my, yeah.
We'll get
digits.
You continue on.
Okay. Let's see. For Prudhoe Bay, an existing pool rules is in place. So, and the existing offtake allowable at Prudhoe Bay was set in 1977 at 2.7 BCF per day. When we get a gas pipeline, should the operator want a larger allowable, they would have to request a change to the existing Rule 9, which set that offtake. And that is the process by which the Prudhoe Bay operator would get some other allowable. However, if when we get a gas pipeline, 2.7 BCF a day of offtake, including fuel, and export to other fields is sufficient for Prudhoe Bay, then the Prudhoe Bay operator will not have to come back to us for permission to do anything at Prudhoe Bay. So if they're selling, if they're exporting 200 million and they're using 500 million for fuel and they want to sell 2 BCF a day, they could do that without crossing our path. But if they decide that they need more Prudhoe Bay gas to fill the pipeline, they will have to come to us for an allowable.
Yeah. Now, should Alaskans be nervous about what you just said?
Senator Huggins, no. I'm an Alaskan, and I'm not nervous.
Okay. Neither am I, then. Okay, go ahead.
For Point Thompson, an undeveloped pool with no rules in place, a gas offtake allowable rule would be part of the greater process of determining all the rules by which the pool would be developed and operated, in much the same way that we developed pool rules and have followed them at Prudhoe Bay since 1977. Again, the operator would recommend pool rules and request a determination by the AOGCC on those rules. In either of those
If I might, just so that I make sure I've got this correct, that the process would be evolving based on the circumstances in the pool. Is that an
Senator
accurate
Huggins,
statement?
That's exactly right. Okay. The operator comes to us, and for any pool that's discovered, the operator, and they want to move into development on, the operator comes to us. They first look at our regulations and our statutes, and to the extent that the rules that are present there suit their needs, they don't come to us for any special rules. But they come to us, they define the aerial extent of the pool, they define the vertical extent of the pool, and then they ask for all the rules that they need. If they can drill the wells following simply our statewide rules, then they don't have any drilling rules. But if they need special exemption to set the surface casing higher or lower or something, then they come to us and we put a special rule in. Or if they want a rule to be able to put their wells closer together than our statewide rules allow, then they come to us and they request a closer spacing. You know, so all of our rules that exist for the state are in place, but for an oil field, you can't produce the gas. And so Point Thompson would have to come to us for a gas offtake if they want to do anything other than re-inject the gas and use it for fuel.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
In either of these cases, the Prudhoe Bay case or the Point Thompson case, our technical staff would gather sufficient information to make recommendations, and we would hold a hearing. For Prudhoe Bay, we would likely have much of the information we need already by virtue of the Prudhoe Bay study that we completed in 2006. And assuming a successful completion of the Point Thompson study, the same would hold true. And I'm going to anticipate a question and go off script. And unless they come to us many, many years from now, I feel confident that the information that we gathered has a good 4 or 5 year shelf life. So if they come to us, if we get to an open season process in the next 4 to 5 years, we're not going to be coming back asking you for another $500,000 to do another Prudhoe study. At one of these hearings, the operator, our staff, and other interested parties would present to us all of the relevant technical information we need to reach a decision. We would take all of the information presented and make a ruling. And at such a hearing, the information needed to make our decision would become part of the public process and would no longer be confidential. So I'm inviting Senator Wilikowski to those hearings whenever they happen. Let me close with a few very brief take-home messages, and then I'll gladly any other questions that you might have. Number one, by the time we get a gas line, the oil volume left at risk at Prudhoe Bay will not likely be sufficient. Well, I'll take the likely out. It will not be sufficient to derail a gas pipeline. So the right answers for timing and sales volume are, within reason, whenever and however much. However, in the meantime, the Prudhoe Bay operator must be continuing to do all he can to accelerate oil recovery aggressively, avoiding major unplanned shutdowns, and developing and implementing strategies to mitigate oil losses. Number two, at Point Thompson, we have time to minimize the oil losses and the operating cost tax deductions that would result from gas blowdown. But every day that goes by with Point Thompson undeveloped whittles away at that opportunity. We lose our choice. Number three, we need new gas discoveries for the long-term success of the gas pipeline and to help further diminish concern over oil losses at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. Thus, we must encourage these discoveries.
Very good. Question. Under your take-home message number one, after however in the meantime, would you reflect on how successful thus far you think that's been? And that what that really means is the aggressively pursuing oil recovery is the way I read it. And any evolving technology and the application to do it more efficiently, more cost-effectively.
Senator Huggins, in my opinion, as a petroleum engineer and as an AOGCC commissioner who wants to see greater ultimate recovery and prevention of waste, I'm pleased that we have a set of world-class owners at Prudhoe Bay. Among the three key owners, major owners, Conoco, Exxon, and BP, they're leaders in developing and implementing technology worldwide, and all three of those companies recognize Prudhoe Bay as a major asset, so they're putting the full force of their technological resources to bear in developing Prudhoe. And if you go back to that chart that I hate for y'all to look at because you asked me questions, 60% recovery from a reservoir like Prudhoe Bay is very good. We're lucky to have the operators we've got developing Prudhoe Bay. Now, that said, we've got a lot more life left in Prudhoe Bay, and it's no spring chicken. So it will be incumbent upon the operators to continue to make good investments, use good technology, and be a good operator. And it'll be incumbent upon the AOGCC and the DNR and the DEC and you guys to make sure that they know we're right there watching them and making sure that they keep doing that.
Right. Okay. Heavy oil is going to be the question. As I recall, Alberta claims that they have 175 billion barrels of known recoverable reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia. And as by their numbers, we have about 4 billion, much smaller number in any event, and doesn't really register on the Richter scale in the international order of merit. However, in the oil sands, I mean, and Senator Wagner knows this better than I do, but it's clearly their challenge of extracting that oil may be greater than ours. I think that. And I think the production cost is $24 a barrel, as I recall. But they can't build enough houses, can't get enough people, enough loaves of bread, all those sorts of things, because people coming in there and the employment demand. When we go through heavy oil conversations that I've heard here minimally, quite often the reflection I hear is, well, we're working on heavy oil extraction, and we think we can get there, but we're not there yet. Are you confident we can get there? Are you concerned about heavy oil in Alaska, or should we just assume that it's going to happen?
Senator Huggins, confidence is a funny thing.
Yeah.
My confidence might not be the same as yours. We are starting to develop heavy oil. You know, West Sac is in production. Schrader Bluff is in production. Orion, Polaris, some of the equivalents at Prudhoe Bay are in production. Those are the easier to get heavy oil. But as you get into the more viscous oils, the current technology and, you know, coupled with the current costs of doing business on the North Slope, it's the combination of the two. It's not simply the technology or simply the cost. It's the combination of the two are problematic for us. I've heard a number of people say, and I've heard myself say, that if the huge West Sac resource were located in California, well, maybe not in California, but in West Texas, it'd already be depleted. We would have developed it 50 years ago. But it's cold up there. The viscosity is related to both the temperature and the fluid composition of the oil. So the cold doesn't help. The cost of doing business up there doesn't help. But if this field were in a lower 48, it'd be depleted. If these heavy oil resources were in an easier to get to place, they'd be depleted. So in that regard, I have some confidence that it's such a huge prize that we'll continue to whittle away at it and figure it out.
Right.
And one last thing. When you talk about how huge the Canadian tar sands are and how our little 2 or 4 billion barrels doesn't make the international scene. Okay, take the 2 billion barrels that are left at Prudhoe Bay and compare it to the biggest discovery that's been made in North America in the last 10 years, and that would be the Thunder Horse in the offshore Gulf of Mexico. That was a huge, huge discovery that it got all kinds of press. And at its onset, it's 1 billion barrels. With you know, before they've started producing it. So we've got this little leftover baby of 2 billion barrels, and it's twice as big as the biggest discovery that's been made in North America in the last 10 years. So, you know, don't undersell the value of that huge resource we have up there.
Oh, no, no. But let me ask that wasn't one more time. Your confidence level in us recovering the heavy oil with some satisfaction, revenue flow-wise, is high or low?
I beg your pardon?
Your confidence in recovering the heavy oil is high or low? Your confidence?
It's high, but I'm a patient person.
Okay.
And so I don't think it's going to be during this session or, you know, okay. We'll probably have a gas pipeline built while we're still figuring it out.
Yeah. Other questions, Kathy? One more question then, seeing none here, and it has to do, Point Thompson's your number two take-home message. We know Fort Thompson is in dispute, litigation, ever how you want to describe it. And that's going to take some time to resolve. But the fundamental question remains, will Point Thompson in its development, in your estimation, meet the timeline of a gas pipeline in the window of 10 to 15 years from now?
Senator Huggins, in my estimation, it will. But I say that with the caveat that I don't know how long the litigation will last.
I understand.
But assuming that reasonable people make reasonable decisions,
right,
then it will happen in the timeline that we've got.
Okay. And if you factor out litigation with the assumption that it's resolved soon, in a matter of single-digit years, one or two or so, your confidence level goes up.
Senator Huggins, my confidence level goes way up. Then I start to worry that they resolve their problems before we've finished our study,
right,
because we still have a year to do on our study.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kathy. Any other questions? Okay, reminder to the committee that we'll meet right here tomorrow. We'll have Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources, and we'll talk about tax rates and tax regimes nationally and internationally. And Kevin Banks, we haven't forgotten about you. What's the answer? And Kevin, before you say anything, you consistently think you sit in the back of the room and we won't be able to recognize you back there. We got you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Senator Huggins, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kevin Banks. I'm the acting director of the Division of Oil and Gas. Well, let's see if I can do some arithmetic for you. You heard Commissioner Forster say that the per barrel oil equivalent of gas is about 6 MCF of gas for each barrel of oil. Well, in fact, today at, you know, an $8 price of gas at an MCF and $90 barrel of oil, that ratio is different, obviously. And so doing some quick arithmetic of the 460 million cubic feet of gas that is being used for fuel, that's about something less than $4 million, about $3.6 million a day in fuel, but it's producing $35 million worth of barrel of oil. So that's the arithmetic that her accountant husband is paying attention to.
Senator Wilkowski,
is the state compensated for that usage?
No, that would be called fuel gas, and it's used on the lease, and as a consequence, it is we don't receive a royalty for it, nor is it subject to tax.
Senator Wagner.
But in a way, we are compensated because 12.5% of that production is ours.
You bet.
So, you know,
I guess the point I'm making is there's no incentive for efficient use of that gas, and I guess that's my concern. And so when I see a statement made that
I think, Ms. Through the chair, efficient is the word. Commissioner Forster's got an efficiency with respect to an engineer's perspective, and I take an economics perspective. Can't hardly argue with the value of gas versus the value of the oil production you get for it.
I understand that, except, and all I'm saying is that we're using the equivalent of 77,000 barrels of oil a day, and maybe that's being used at optimal efficiency, and maybe we can be doing it for half that and saving a couple million dollars per day.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, every month, every operator has to submit to the AOGCC a gas disposition report, and they have to quantify for us every way that they use, every bit of gas that they use. And we have an engineer, we have a statistician and an engineer who look at those reports every month. And when they're doing something that looks out of line, we call them, we send them letters, we make them come in and explain to us, and we find them if we find out that they have been inefficient with their use. So I can't guarantee you that if they had a more modern compressor up there, it might be more efficient, but the stuff that they've got up there was the best they could get when they put it up there, and they're accountable to us every month for how they use the gas.
And I appreciate hearing that. That's not exactly what was said before, but I appreciate that is what's happening.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kevin. Appreciate it very much. Okay, reminder, 11 o'clock here tomorrow, and we will continue the conversation with DOR and DNR on tax regimes. Thank you very much. And with that, we are adjourned.